really my pleasure to welcome Rebecca Johnson today from the University of Victoria to speak with us in our Short Conversations with Legal Theorists series. Could you please introduce yourself in a few words?
Sure. I actually sat last night trying to figure out how I would introduce myself in a few short words, because it's a really interesting question, how we decide to place ourselves at the beginning of a conversation. And I had a few ways of introductions that I was thinking of, one which was to position myself in terms of my lineages, thinking of many of the kind of indigenous practices of introduction. And so I was thinking, I'm the product of settlers who came from Britain to the US and Canada in the 1800s and settled in Treaty 7 territory. I live now in Coast Salish territory in Vancouver, on Vancouver Island in Victoria, where I teach at the University of Victoria in kind of unceded Sayout, Songhees, Esquimalt, Saanich territories. But I'm here in Chiquipmulu right now, which you can see out the window in the Shuswap interior of BC at my family's place. I mean, I've said I teach in a law school, and so that will start our conversation about what it is that we do. But at the heart of that is also that I am the oldest of eight kids, with, you know, eight aunts and uncles on each side. I think it's not irrelevant to our conversations about theory and theorizing and what gives me pleasure in the universe, trying to make sense of what it is to belong to different kinds of communities. I love theory. I think it's the most delicious thing that's there in the universe. And I'm completely obsessed with law and culture and popular culture and the ways that law kind of lives in our bodies and lives in the world around us, and that thinking about how theory can help us really make sense of who we are and our relationships with each other and with the world around us.
That's a fantastic way to go in through my next question, which is in fact about our field and how is that we define our field. So my course in ALAR is called Jurisprudence and Critical Approaches to Law. But how would you define jurisprudence, and how would you characterize your own approach? And do you like to call it jurisprudence? Do you like to call it theory, legal theory, philosophy of law? Is there a particular name you like best?
I love this question. And again, so, you know, this is the, I don't know when people will be watching this, but here we are in COVID times. I'm at my mother's place at the lake, where I've got, you know, 60 relatives all circulating around. And so we were up playing board games at 1 o'clock in the morning, me and my sisters. And I was asking her, okay, so how would you answer these for me tomorrow? And we spent a lot of time on the jurisprudence question, which is really about language and the significance of how and why we name things the way we do. So a dictionary, jurisprudence from the Latin, juris, law, prudence, knowledge of. I would have said jurisprudence is philosophy of law, but in the etymology, it's more like knowledge of law. And so I was thinking what it is to imagine a world in which law is something you can have knowledge of. So something that feels a bit outside of yourself, that can be grabbed and mastered and held on to and theorized and understood. So I like that. But I also find myself often thinking about the ways that law lays inside the body, in the way that it structures who we are and how we understand that law is often something performed more than kind of known. And so I think sometimes I like additional ways of describing our shared projects, and that sometimes I might use words like theory more frequently. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that we'd have different, you know, different things that we do, but the words, all these choices, social theory, social critic, jurisprudential thinker, all get us at this really difficult thing of figuring out how to make sense of a world that's partially outside of us, partially inside of us, and that structures how we are in the world. Mm-hmm. So I love even talking about the words that we use to describe mm-hmm. what we do, that this is like the joys of translation, like what right. the different words we use to describe what we do can help us talk to each other about how we see and understand the world.
Yeah. As you're talking about language and translation, and there is a particular theorist that comes to my mind, but I wanted to ask you, is there a particular author that has influenced your approach or understanding of law?
I was saying to you earlier before we started, I love the syllabus that the students have for this year for theory. In some ways, because I feel like it's resonating strands with people who've been really important in my own thinking or who have nourished my thought. So I love James Boyd White's materials and readings. And for me, he's a person who is on my committee and whose work really shaped my thinking about legal imagination, justice as translation, words losing meaning, all of kind of those questions that come out of law and literature that help us think about how our world of legal thinking is also structured by theory and language. It's so crucial to the work that we do. James Boyd White's work has been really important to my thinking. Mm-hmm. On your syllabus this year, the students are also going to be reading Patricia Williams. Mm-hmm. And Patricia Williams is someone that I read when I was in my first year of grad school at Michigan, and whose work completely kind of rocked my world in terms of making so visible the place of the body in legal thought. And I think before I encountered Patricia Williams, I would have mostly used the word jurisprudence, and I mostly would have thought about kind of a canon of white male scholars that I don't dismiss. I find them super valuable. I've learned so much from reading Hart and Fuller and their kind of conversations about what makes law, and then supplemented by this reminder that bodies are super important sites of theory. So Patricia Williams has been really important in my thinking, as has Jennifer Nadelsky with her work on relationality, which really ties these questions of the outside to the inside to remind us to both turn ourselves outside, but to think about the ways that we are implicated in the things that we see kind of outside of us. So even those just starting to touch your syllabus, there's so many people in the universe who can really help us think about where we are.
Thinking in terms of those theories or even of the place of theory or jurisprudence within law schools, where do you see the role of jurisprudence in law schools, and do you see a value in students taking this course?
I was thinking again about my very first jurisprudence course that I ever took, which was in an undergraduate kind of philosophy of law course after I had finished my first degree, which was in music. And I was trying to figure out what to do in my life, and I would touch my tongue out like a snake onto law to see what the flavor of that was through jurisprudence. I was kind of struck at the time by sometimes it felt like it was distant. So there was new languages I was having to learn, and I kept having to write down ontology and epistemology over and over again because I couldn't keep clear from my music school background what these words were that people were trying to use to talk about. So it felt a little bit distant, but also big questions like, how do we know what law is? How do we know how we're governed? How do we know what's legitimate? How do we solve problems? Like, what is authority? Those are monster questions. But when I first started encountering them, I hadn't explicitly thought about them. I'd been more thinking about, am I in a treble clef or the bass clef? Where's the conductor? How are we pulling the music together? I'd been thinking kind of structures of music. The more I started to play in jurisprudence, the more I started thinking about shared understandings, right, in the worlds of musical structures and legal structures. How are they different? How are they similar? And there was this kind of weird moment when these questions that at first felt distant, I started kind of seeing how those things had some resonances with other kinds of questions that I had in a new language. Then as I really plunged into law more actively with those big questions in my mind, I found that having them in mind really helped me make sense of my own life. So my love for theory is less rooted in kind of mastery or of the things outside, but of realizing that theorists had something to say about how I lived my life or experienced my life as a woman, mm-hmm. for example, mm-hmm. sort of gendered mm-hmm. experiences that I had that seemed sometimes to be super personal, but that the more I looked outside to theory, I could find theorists who could help me see structures so that I could mm-hmm. understand better how much range of flexibility I had within a structure and how to target my energies for change to places where there were moments to insert myself into a structure and figure out what it was that could be shifted, kind of like, mm-hmm. you know, playing at the beach and a stream coming down and realizing, you know, where water goes over a certain rock creates certain kinds of movements that if I wanted things to change, I needed to go further up the stream to see what was happening. Mm-hmm. But theory is really powerful for this because it doesn't tell you what to do. It helps you see the world in a different way that opens up possibilities for both understanding and for talking to mm-hmm. each other in different ways. So I find theory has meaning for how I live my life in my family, how I live my life with my children, how I interact with the land, how I find joy in the world around me. If a person understands theory as something that is a set of tools to help you live your life and interact with others, then theory is super powerful and super delicious and tasty.
So it leaves with you, or it goes with you wherever you are, and it helps you understand certain things.
It goes with you absolutely wherever you are, if you choose to take it.
Indeed.
Yeah, you can't leave home without theory. Theory's with you all the time. You just might not know you have a theory. That's the challenge, is realizing, oh my gosh, I had a theory all this time and I didn't know it. I don't like this theory. I think I want another one.
That's a very interesting process that you're describing also. Theory as something which exists outside on the one hand, and then how you bring it home to live your life with or through theory. I want to speak about something which you have already alluded to, which is your role as a member of the Indigenous Legal Research Unit at the University of Victoria. And of course, you work quite closely with Indigenous legal scholars. You have yourself written about Indigenous law. And so I wanted to ask you how that engagement with Indigenous law has itself shaped your understanding of law generally. What kind of impact it has had in your own process?
As a Canadian girl being raised largely in Canada, it's been a very interesting voyage over the past 25 or so years of teaching and living in a law school context to really start knowing different stories about law and its place in Canada. So often when I've been thinking about law, dreaming about law, it's been law within a common law context or law as understood within a civil law context. Mm-hmm. Some engagement with maybe customary law, but learning to see the presence of Indigenous legal orders in the universe around one is another exercise in translation and mind expansion for the realm of possible ways one can live in a lawful way, even in the context of brutal, brutal mm-hmm. histories of colonization, dispossession and violence, because there's no way to sugarcoat that. If a person doesn't just like, okay, we are in the matrix. Do you want the red pill or the blue pill? So do you want to be awake or do you want to be asleep? Mm-hmm. And unless you want to be asleep, there is no way to say, oops, colonization. Well, we're done that. Now we do a game reset and we move forward. But if you're confronted with this problem, and this is a problem of theory as well, right? A theory and legitimacy and authority and lawfulness, all of my roots are so deeply embedded in territories that are marked by histories of dispossession. So I have this beautiful land outside of me right now. I've spent every summer of my life out here with family, and I love this place. My blood is linked to this place. I adore this place. And I have this place because other people dispossessed the the Shakwapan people who lived in this territory for 20,000 years. Mm-hmm. So how do I situate and place myself in a way that lets me believe that I am a lawful person, that I am a person who has the integrity to live within a lawful order, and that I am not like one of Hitler's little helpers? Like, what's the story that's available to me to let me live in a lawful way in the context of that history? So here's where theory becomes really, really important if you don't want to just drink the drink of forgetfulness and oblivion. So I think those big questions have been in my head as I have been very, very lucky to work with astonishing colleagues, both at UVic, at UBC, across Canada, who've been working to revitalize or to stand back up or to make visible to settlers the wide range of Indigenous legal orders present across North America. And a question I often get from people is, well, you're sort of, hello, white settler girl, what are you doing this work? What's your place in it? So those are super awesome questions that I often answer by saying, if you are in Canada and you live in a territory where there is a treaty, I was born in Treaty 7 territory, whether or not I understand what the legal order of the Indigenous peoples of that area is, I'm bound by the treaty. So for me to be in treaty territory, to see myself as lawful there, means I need to know not only the Canadian legal order, but also the legal order of the other treaty that governs me. So those laws are my laws in a meaningful way, not in a kind of pretend or superficial way, not in the way that I disavow any responsibility for knowing them or beginning to learn them or beginning to engage with them. So from my perspective, the work of starting to engage with Indigenous legal orders, people living in this territory, it's real and it's doable. And we are all going to be baby learners along the way, but legal theory helps us here too, because it also helps us think about processes of learning and processes of learning anything, whether it's how to walk, how to speak, right? Begin with baby steps of learning to babble, right? Learning to crawl, learning to stumble without judgment of each other, but with the knowledge that that's the only way forward, right? To become literate legal scholars, able to move within and in conjunction with legal orders that are both our own and of the legal orders that surround us. This is the place where literacy comes back in, that we learn how to be literate in orders that we follow and in the orders of others that we learn how to respect and how to know enough to engage with them. So learning how to have conversations.
In that process of learning that you are talking about, I'm curious to see what is that motivated you to focus on film, to choose film as a medium to engage with legal questions. Why film, and what do you find in film that perhaps you don't find in different cultural forms?
I love stories. I love people telling me stories. I love listening to stories. I love reading stories. And much of the work that we do at the Indigenous Law Research Unit, we work with stories as one of the ways to think and talk about law. Story is not the only way. Like, one can learn law through language, through practices, through song, through ceremony, through trial transcripts. You know, there's many ways to engage into the world that we work in. But story is super, super powerful. And I think it's deep in our DNA. It's a primary way we learn in the universe. And as you change, your orientation to the story over time also shifts around. So I love story. And I also think with film in particular, film gives us access to story in ways that really hit our body. So we have a narrative, the story that we're imagining. We see things, we hear things, and these different ways of processing in our body, what we see, what we hear, accessing a whole bunch of our different capacities of being embedded learners. So story, and it can go in different ways. Story's got this really rich, robust filmic stories, this rich, robust way of inviting us in and kind of poking us, like, here's a thing, what do you think? Well, here's a thing, how do those fit together? Do they fit together? Where do you process yourself? So a film is never just like a text that rolls out and teaches us. You are drawn in, and we've all had this experience. You sit with a group of people after the movie talking about it. Someone hates it, someone loves it, someone's ambivalent. So right. The story does not live without its interpreters, and there's no one interpretation of the story. So the story kind of grabs us and pulls us in into engagements, and often it's the conversation about the story where we start learning about ourselves, about others, where we can change our idea about the story, where we can imagine how it might go. It's a tool for thinking. So for me, in some ways, that links back to the Indigenous law work that we do, because the story isn't the holder of all law, that with engagement does enable us to do the work of law, which is the work of the hard conversations with each other in order to live with each other in the world, with the environment, with others who have different ways of seeing. But story is this powerful, powerful scaffold that hold these things and hold us. You know, you give students hard texts to work with, and those are important texts, and they're worth engaging with. But at the beginning, when people begin working with theory and theorists, it's easy to believe that those texts are somehow different. So when students would, if I would give them, you know, part of the Hart Fuller debates, some students would just feel that they didn't get it, or that they were wrong, or they hadn't read it enough, or that they felt excluded by the text. Like, those texts are equally robust and pleasurable to taste and to work with. But it's harder to feel comfortable within the vocabulary at the beginning, so that you know that you are an interpreter who's invited in. With film, it's an easier move in. It's easier for people to understand that the conversation around the text is actually the thing, right? I love film. It's a powerful, empowering place to really critique our pleasures and ask ourselves why we like what we like and why others don't, and how that can help us learn about each other and ourselves.
You are yourself a very creative scholar and also a teacher, but somehow I feel that the role of creativity is not necessarily fostered in law school. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about this. How do you see the role of creativity for law students in the law school, in your own teaching?
A lot of people talk about the changing legal profession. What will, here we are again, COVID times, like things are changing. We have to do things in different ways. How will law work? And in the kind of reports about the most important skills for legal professionals, especially 5, 10, 15 years out, the studies really often speak to the need for creativity. So if law is anything, it's not a set of rules to guide us, it's a way of thinking and organizing for solving human problems and for, solving human problems, helping us to organize ourselves in large collectives in the world. But in order to do that, we have to have skills of creativity and responsiveness for conditions that we don't yet know. So you're torn between the need for certainty and stability and this flexibility that's kind of crucial. We see this in a lot of theorists looking at this problem, right, at the heart of law, that we're strung between these two poles and posts. But responsiveness, the ability to see something, to imagine that there's another path, to talk to others with it, to harness people to imagined possibilities, those skills, they're crucial. And in the ways that our large-scale social organization has gone over the past, let's call it 150 or 200 years.
That's what I was going to say.
Kind of, neoliberal, certain kinds of colonial moves where there's been a lot of attention to kind of imperial structures, to move forward, progress narratives, hold the world together in one large, one ring to bind them all, find them in the darkness and bind them. These singularities that have been so much part of education, kids need to sit in school from this hour to this hour. It happens to match the hours that their parents need to be there. Clock in, clock out, 15-minute coffee break. You know, like it's hard to find spaces of creativity in the large structures that organize us through so many dimensions of our life. How do we nurture and nourish our own creativity in the face of large-scale structures that try to push us in the direction of stability? So it's one of the big challenges in law, like in every other place, how to find ways of organizing ourselves to create spaces where creativity and play can happen, where we're invited to make mistakes, where we're invited to try things out. So some of the things that many scholars, including myself, have been trying in the context of law schools is to try and embed opportunities for some different forms of creativity that are legal. Like, we're not talking go off and play, but you know, play is a pretty important source of theorizing and of experiential mm-hmm. learning. So we learn as much from our failures as from anything else. So it's about trying to empower people to realize that in a theory course, for example, you can take theory to drawing. You can take theory to how you think about music. You can use theory to think about how, you know, what you cook in the kitchen and how products are put together. You know, I'm out here right now doing pottery over the summer, playing with clay. And for me, clay is another of those places of legal theorizing. So an occasion to think about what happens with time and transformation as you spin something that was once sand into something that's solid, something that will return to the earth again. What's the relationship between, you know, what's in here and what's in here? What are the chemical differences between the two of us? You know, so how does this help us with law? Well, maybe in ways that are maybe not obvious, but that actually maybe help us think about things like long temporal change. What are the relationships between things and places over time? And what can be learned by finding places where we have an opportunity to stop the chatter of our minds by focusing on tasks, by building things in the world that are manageable, right? I think creativity is not to be underestimated, and it also shouldn't be overestimated. It's like the goal isn't to produce works of art. The goal is to see ourselves as in engagement with the materials of the world, knowing that those engagements actually help us develop connections in our minds, in our relationships with others, that might help us solve problems down the road. So again, creativity is one of those parts of the human mind. It's part of legal thinking, and it's an important part of legal thinking. And theory, it's a site of creativity if people can accept that the goal there isn't to only learn jurisprudence in the narrowest sense where it's the knowledge of that which is outside, but is jurisprudence knowledge of the law which embeds us, you know, in relationship mm-hmm. to it, and celebrates that the pathways towards problem solving are multiple, right? And theory can be our friend.
I would actually like to conclude with that beautiful statement you just made of theory being our friend, not without thanking you very much for talking to us, talking to our class, of your students, and hoping that our conversation can continue.
The pleasure is totally mine, because it's theory pleasure. I hope students enjoy the class.
I hope they do.